Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 19th, 2010, from WILLAM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We have a show today that I've been looking forward to. One of our most popular guests is returning to talk about his brand new book, and an extraordinary book it is. Our guest is going to be Chris Hedges, author of Death of the Liberal Class, today on Media Matters. But before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. In a two-day marathon this week, SaveTheInternet.com coalition allies and activists delivered 2 million petitions for real net neutrality to the Federal Communications Commission before the close of the public comment period on new FCC rules. The petitions, collected from across the country, urged the FCC to stand up for real net neutrality and to safeguard the open Internet. The agency is scheduled to vote on its proposed net neutrality rules at its December 21st open meeting. Called the Can You Hear Us Now-a-thon, dozens of local volunteers and members of public interest groups hauled tens of thousands of petitions to the FCC's doorstep every hour. James Losey, program associate with the Open Technology Initiative at the New America Foundation, said the mountain of petitions waiting to be delivered created a stunning visual protest for net neutrality. Losey was among the first to make a drop-off early Monday morning.
It was great to know that I'm putting down the first few drops in this bucket, but the rest of the flood is coming later.
Eddie Geller, founder of the Open Source Democracy Foundation, flew all the way from Los Angeles to be a part of the event.
To have in your hands all these names of people who care about this issue and who want a truly free and open internet, it's very empowering to walk over to an office and say, here are thousands of real people who want to be heard.
Geller echoed the sentiment that net neutrality is one of the most fundamental free speech issues of our time.
Well, the internet is an incredible tool for free speech. It's such a democratic platform that anyone can get online and they can make their voice heard with a very low barrier to entry. We feel so strongly that the internet needs to stay that way.
Photos, blog posts, and videos documenting the marathon can be found at marathon.savetheinternet.com.
Editorial cartoons are consistently among the most read and most clipped items in newspapers. Yet the number of editorial cartoonists is shrinking at an alarming rate. In the past month, at least three well-known cartoonists were let go, including Pulitzer Prize winner Matt Davies of Westchester County's Journal News. As newspapers began consolidating, cartoonists were laid off in record numbers. Back in the 1960s, there were about 200 full-time cartoonists. Their ranks have shrunk to just 67, leaving many papers without local political cartoons. Steve Greenberg is a prize-winning California-based cartoonist. For several years, he worked for the Ventura County Star, owned by E.W. Scripps. He was let go in 2008, after the presidential election. Greenberg says that more cartoonists are let go after every election. He calls the cuts ironic.
The editors of newspapers realize the value of the cartoonist, and they keep them on until the election because the cartoons have some impact on the election. And then once the election is over, then the bean counters higher up in corporate feel that, okay, that moment has passed, now we'll cut somebody and let's get rid of the cartoonists because they're seen as luxuries.
But Greenberg says editorial cartoons are anything but a luxury. The public is losing yet another important watchdog.
You know, a cartoonist calling attention to a local issue can have a lot of impact, sometimes more than a written editorial, because people will see the cartoons even if they don't intend to, you know, flipping through the pages. The cartoon is a quick read, a quick impact, and the message is imparted before the reader even decides whether or not they want to see it.
Many laid-off cartoonists are eking out a living through syndication and scrambling to find other opportunities for cartooning. Others, like Greenberg, have been picked up by the local weekly alternative paper, and some are freelancing. Gone are the days where they would enjoy the benefits of full-time employment. The Association of Editorial Cartoonists has begun a new campaign to educate the public about the value of editorial cartooning.
Instead of bemoaning the loss of our jobs, we're trying to change this around, put a positive spin on what editorial cartoonists mean to their newspapers, what they mean to the community and to the readers, and why it's beneficial to have editorial cartoonists. So this is an exciting potential development.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Our guest today is a writer who's been on the show a couple times before, and he's here to talk about his new book. Our guest is Chris Hedges, author of the brand new book, Death of the Liberal Class, just published by Nation Books, which I've had the privilege of reading over the last week. Chris Hedges has written several other books that he's been on the show to talk about, including Empire of Illusion and American Fascists. He is a longtime journalist and Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Now he writes as a freelancer, works with the Nation Institute, and writes books like Death of the Liberal Class. Chris Hedges, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you.
And Chris, let me start by reading just a couple of lines from the towards the end of your book that are striking, even jarring, and then work from there to explain the crisis and the role of the liberal class and all of it. But towards the end of the book, you write, "We stand on the verge of one of the bleakest periods in human history, when the bright lights of civilization will blink out and we will descend for decades, if not centuries, into barbarity." And then a couple pages later, you write, "The 10,000-year experiment of settled life is about to come to a crashing halt." I think, you know, that sums up your argument, and I think it's absolutely the logic of where your argument goes. And so why don't just, to put those words into context briefly, explain the nature of the crisis as you see it, what drives you to write this book, what causes it, and then quickly what the role of the liberal class is, and then we'll go into detail.
Well, the nature of the crisis is defined by the corporate coup d'etat that has been carried out, and that it's over. They've won and we've lost. It is a gradual, we are watching a gradual disempowerment of the American public. It is the commodification of everything, human beings, the natural world, that corporations exploit until exhaustion or collapse, which is why the environmental crisis, and we just finished Cancun, where in essence the heads of the industrialized world just pretended that global warming wasn't happening, and most of the commercial media barely covered it. It wasn't even a story. The collective suicide that has become our assault, or it will be the result of our assault on the ecosystem that sustains the human species. The commodification of life by corporations means that American society is being hollowed out from the inside. We're rapidly reconfiguring American democracy into a brutal form of neo-feudalism where there are serfs and masters. And ultimately, this destruction will obliterate the power elite itself, but not until the very end, because, as Naomi Klein points out, they have the capacity to retreat into gated communities where they have access to service goods and protection that is denied to the rest of us. And I think that when you walk into the post-industrial pockets of American society, and I just did a story on Camden, New Jersey, for The Nation magazine, you can get a good window into what much of the country is going to look like. There is no supermarket in the center of Camden because agribusinesses have reconfigured the food distribution system, which means that if you live in New Jersey, as I do, you have to buy your tomatoes and fruits and other vegetables from California, and it's expensive. And if you're poor, you can't afford it. So they don't sell tomatoes to poor people. In places like Camden, you subsist off of Church's fried chicken and donuts, grease and sugar. Obama has done nothing to halt that process. So I certainly believe in resistance, we have no impediments within the formal mechanisms of power at this point to thwart the destruction of the corporate state.
And Chris Hedges, the title of the book, Death of the Liberal Class, I mean, your book is about the role in a better society a liberal class should play and the role our liberal class is not playing, and it's culpability then for the current situation. Who is the liberal class? What do you mean by that, and why are, to put words in your mouth, why are they failing?
Well,
why have they failed even?
I go back to World War I because I think it's a very seminal moment. On the eve of World War I, you had powerful populist, progressive, radical forces that had built significant mass movements and systems of communication that terrified the power elite. We had a few dozen socialist mayors. Eugene Debs pulled a million votes when he ran for president. And as the great writer Dwight MacDonald points out, the war was the rock on which these movements broke. The war was highly unpopular. Americans didn't want to fight it. When Wilson declared it, very, very few people volunteered and he had to institute conscription almost immediately. We went into the war primarily because Wall Street and the bankers, which had lent tremendous sums of money to Britain and France, were terrified that if the Germans won the war, they wouldn't be paid back. And so they built this first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, or the Creel Commission, because it was led by this former muckraker named George Creel, who ended his career working for Nixon and McCarthy and the House on American Affairs Committee, not surprisingly, in the 50s. And it crossed disciplinary lines. It had its own film division out of Hollywood. It had its own news division that disseminated pro-war, quote-unquote, news stories to every paper in the country. And those papers that weren't willing to run those stories or take an editorial stance in support of the war, like The Masses, were shut down. Appeal to Reason, which was the fourth largest, had the fourth largest circulation in the country and was a socialist journal, did editorially support the war to stay open, but they shut that magazine down after the war. But more importantly, aside from, you know, creating speakers' bureaus and all this kind of stuff, they employed the techniques of mass psychology, crowd psychology, that had been investigated by writers like Le Bon, Trotter, and finally Sigmund Freud. Edward Bernays, the sort of father of public relations, comes out of the Creel Commission, and he's Freud's nephew twice over. And this was the understanding that people were not moved by fact or reason, but by the manipulation of emotion, what Walter Lippmann, who comes out as a very dark figure in his 1922 book, Public Opinion, calls manufacturing consent. And once this war was over, and Randolph Bourne and Jane Addams write quite poignantly about it, about how there wasn't need for much overt repression because most people, including members of the Socialist Party and leading critics and intellectuals, were seduced by the war effort. And once the war was over, American society was reconfigured forever. All of these people migrated out of the Creel Commission to Madison Avenue, working at this point for corporations and government, which is how in 1954, with the Arbenz coup in Guatemala, the CIA hires Edward Bernays' public relations firm to create the propaganda that leads to public support for the overthrow of the democratically elected government in Guatemala. And you have this installation of consumption as a kind of inner compulsion, which is what corporations want, coupled with this kind of permanent war psychology, the permanent fear, so that the dreaded Hun is instantly replaced with the dreaded Red. Now, the destruction of these powerful populist and radical movements becomes very important because these are the movements that keep the liberal class honest. The liberal class has a very strange relationship. It posits itself publicly as the moral conscience of the society, and yet it is tolerated by the power elite. One thinks of the press, universities, the church, the Democratic Party, culture, labor, all of these traditional pillars of the liberal establishment are tolerated as long as they don't question the virtues and intentions of the power elite. They can critique the processes by which they carry things out, but not the intentions. They can't, for instance, attack the structure of capitalism itself. This immediately sees them pushed by liberals outside of the liberal class. And yet the liberal class is a vital component to a functioning democracy because it makes piecemeal or incremental reform possible. It functions as a kind of safety valve. So when there is widespread discontent, as we saw in the 1930s with the breakdown of capitalism, you have all sorts of sit-down strikes and bonus marchers and all sorts of powerful radical and populist agitation that that puts enough pressure on liberal institutions and liberal figures, people like Roosevelt or his vice president, Henry Wallace, so that we get the New Deal. That's a classic example. And as Conrad Black points out in his biography of Roosevelt, what Roosevelt did, of course, was save capitalism. When that safety valve breaks down, when these liberal institutions, which has happened in the last few decades with the rise of what they call neoliberalism, where you have self-identified liberals, people like Clinton or Obama, who in fact work against the core or traditional values of liberalism, which is to protect the interests of those outside of the narrow power elite, to protect the rights of workers, or at least not be deaf to the rights of workers in the middle class, then you have a very frightening phenomenon, which is that since the normal mechanisms or the formal structures of change no longer work, you see, as we are, leaping up around the fringes of our society, these very frightening, emotionally consistent but utterly irrational movements as embodied in things like the Tea Party or militias or the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party. So the liberal class plays a vital role in a civic society, and when it's wiped out, then, as Dostoevsky was obsessed with this and was the subject of Demons and Notes from Underground, then you enter what he calls an age of moral nihilism. And I think Notes from Underground is probably the most important book for our time. The underground man, the person who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," and now feels betrayed and retreats in a kind of cynicism and apathy and disdain for those who inherit power because they're all idiots. When that happens, then you open the doors to very frightening political configurations, whether ultimately in Russia, the Lenin and the Bolsheviks, or Weimar vomiting about Hitler, or Yugoslavia, a very similar scenario that ends with figures like Radovan Karadzic and Franjo Tuđman and Slobodan Milosevic.
Our guest today on Media Matters you've just been listening to is Chris Hedges, the author of the new book, Death of the Liberal Class, which has just been published by Nation Books. Chris Hedges, former Pulitzer Prize, well, still Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, formerly with the New York Times as a foreign correspondent, has written several books, been a guest on our show before. He'd like to call in with questions or comments for Chris Hedges. The number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455, and Chris, for a living, I read books, either for my research or teaching or for this program. And I can say that this book, although the subject is obviously of the utmost importance, was one of the more enjoyable. I mean, you're a great writer. The words just fly off the page as I read it. And I recommend it to our listeners on those grounds alone, not to mention the content, which you're hearing about right now. Before we go into the book a little bit more, Chris Hedges, I wanted to ask you about a couple current events that have taken place that I'd like to get your take on. First of all, the WikiLeaks story, what's going on right now, which seems quite pertinent to the arguments you're making in the book, because you spend a lot of time talking about the national security state.
Well, we're watching. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the Internet, although I will cede that it has some benefits. In terms of the dissemination of even much of my own work. But the Internet functions like Walmart. It kills all other systems of communication, including newsprint, and bookstores. And once the Internet has a monopoly on disseminating systems of information, then corporations will, as they have in the case of WikiLeaks and government, step in to control what information is passed on to a public. And the collaboration of Amazon and Citibank and PayPal and all sorts of corporate interests on the Internet to silence WikiLeaks is a kind of terrifying window into where we're going. We live in a period of stability, relative stability, despite the suffering that has been visited on our dispossessed working class, courtesy, of course, of liberal, so-called liberal figures like Clinton with NAFTA, welfare reform, so-called welfare reform, and deregulation of the FCC and destruction of the banking system. But we still live in a period of relative stability. Although if we don't radically alter our monetary and our military policies, that stability will eventually be shattered. It's inevitable. You can't sustain an empire as we do by borrowing $2 billion a day from the Chinese. I mean, ultimately it has to stop. We've racked up the largest deficits in human history, which frankly we can't repay. And we're watching, we just watched the other day as the Russians and the Chinese cut a trade deal no longer to use the dollar as the reserve currency. Much more of that, and the dollar becomes junk. And I've lived through three currency crises, one in Argentina, one in Nicaragua, and one in the Yugoslavia. And when currency collapses in a kind of hyperinflation, then you open that Pandora's box, which makes possible very frightening and terrifying political configurations.
So as far as WikiLeaks goes and the arrest of Julian Assange and the whole question of state secrets, how do you see this playing out? Is this an important issue going on right now?
Well, it's a harbinger of what the security state will do when they feel threatened. And I don't think in any fundamental sense the security state is threatened at this point. We don't have the kind of protests, the street protests that we've seen in Greece or France, even Britain. But we will, I think, eventually. And, you know, the rise of the corporate state always brings with it the rise of the surveillance and security state and the methods for control that we have allowed to be handed to the state are terrifying. I mean, even that is part of the great tragedy of the Obama administration is that they've codified the destruction of international and domestic law that were put in place by the Bush administration. They haven't even been able to restore habeas corpus. They have retroactively made legal what under our Constitution is illegal, and that is the warrantless wiretapping and monitoring of tens of millions of American citizens in the so-called FISA Reform Act, which Obama, just one more campaign promise he broke, said that he would filibuster and then ended up supporting when the telecommunications companies flooded Washington with lobbyists and money. So, you pervert the legal system to essentially make it lawful to bind the hands of the citizenry. And our legal system has already been perverted from the Supreme Court down through Congress. And it's relatively benign because we still live in a situation that's relatively stable. But should that stability disintegrate, the tools that are available for state control are really terrifying. And I think WikiLeaks is a window into how draconian those controls will be.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to Chris Hedges, the author of Death of the Liberal Class, just published by Nation Books. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Media Matters, the number here at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now for our first caller. Line 4, Coles County, you're on the air with Chris Hedges.
Yes. Am I on?
You are indeed, sir.
Okay.
I don't know that I agree with everything that's being said, but I will say that I've followed these things for probably over 60 years, and I don't think I've ever seen the left in such an anemic condition as it is today, in my opinion. Not only liberals, but socialists, communists, liberals, and almost everybody on the left. In my opinion, it's a very anemic situation. You have most young people apolitical at best, but even older people are not active. Many people seem to be very afraid. They seem to lack courage. In the case of most people, courage to act, or courage to speak out. There also are many, many arguments for the left that are never even used. I know of many arguments that I'm not going to go into them here, but could be used for the left, to back up the left, and are never used by liberals. But incredibly, many of the arguments are never even used by socialists and communists. And I just find the left to be in a terribly anemic condition, and I don't know that anybody's going to do anything about it, because a lot of people seem unable to function. They seem to not be especially courageous, and they don't seem to have the ideas that they should have to present to the public. What is your comment on that?
Well, thank you very much, caller. And if I can just add a bit to that, since I've had the privilege of reading your book, Chris Hedges, it strikes me that one of the big arguments you're making in the book is along those lines, which is that to have an effective liberal class, you have to have a left.
Right.
And that relationship is the key to what's wrong today. I'll let you take it from there.
Exactly. And without that pressure, I mean, there were two things that happened. One, we saw beginning in World War One, following World War One, with the use of the Espionage and the Sedition Act. It's interesting that they're talking about trying to use the Espionage Act against Assange. We decimated these radical and progressive forces, these forces that held fast around moral imperatives. We saw perhaps the last gasp of that in the 1960s, the civil rights movement, but remember there was fierce, the way that they went after the civil rights movement was to accuse major civil rights leaders of either being communists or being connected with communists, so we saw a kind of reconfiguration of liberal institutions along the lines of anti-communism that after these radical and progressive forces were destroyed like the Wobblies. I mean, utterly obliterated, with finally Big Bill Haywood spending the last 10 years of his life in exile in the Soviet Union on a trumped-up murder charge. We saw an internal purging within liberal institutions. So you had universities, high schools, the press. Thousands of people were pushed out of their jobs for either being communists or soft on communism, although many of them had no relationship to the Communist Party. It's how I.F. Stone, arguably the greatest journalist of the 20th century in America, becomes a pariah. He won't take Truman's loyalty oath, and he can't even get a job at The Nation magazine, and ends up printing I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement with his wife. And these institutions never recovered from those hammer blows. So that by the time the 60s arose, when you had an anti-war movement, labor, which had been united with students and progressive forces before World War One, now actively denounced the anti-war movement, had very little sympathy for the civil rights movement, had not organized in the South because they wouldn't organize black workers, supported people like Lane Kirkland and George Meany publicly supported Nixon's war in Vietnam. That illustrates the shift, the fragmenting, the destruction of labor, of left, of all of these forces that had once existed in a kind of united front. Not to not to belittle the divisions that were there, but at least had been able to speak in the language of class warfare, who had a vocabulary to understand what was happening to them. And the weakening of liberal institutions themselves meant that with the rise of the corporate state begun by Reagan and pushed through by Clinton, self-identified liberals became little more than courtiers to the corporate establishment. And that was done quite consciously by figures like Clinton, who knew that if he did corporate bidding, he would get corporate money, so that by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republican Party, and by the time Barack Obama ran for president, they got more. But what we saw was that although they continued to speak in the traditional language of liberalism, they betrayed the interests of those they purportedly defending, i.e. the working and the middle class. And that hypocrisy has engendered a rage on the fringes of American society that is not misplaced. There is a rage within adherence to the Tea Party movement, not only against government, but against against liberals. And I would say that they're right to be enraged, that liberals like Obama speak hypocritically, very hypocritically, about defending interests that they long ago stopped defending.
Our guest today is Chris Hedges, author of Death of the Liberal Class. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILLAM 580. Our phone line here is 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines to another caller right now. Let's go to line one, Peoria. You're on the air.
Okie dokie. I would like to hear Mr. Hedges' comments, if he would care to, on Richard Holbrooke's career. When I read some of Chris's books, The War is the Force That Gives Us Meaning started me off, and I know that was had a lot to do with the former Yugoslavia, and I just wondered what his thoughts are on Richard Holbrooke's career as a diplomat, where he fell. He has had a lot of... I know he worked very hard and believed in what he did, but, you know, what is... I'd like to hear Mr. Hedges' comment on that.
Well, thank you very much. And Richard Holbrooke is, of course, for those listeners who have been sort of out of the loop, the State Department career diplomat who died this week while he's actively working on negotiations in Afghanistan. Chris Hedges?
Well, I knew Dick Holbrooke very well, of course. I was the Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times during the whole Dayton Peace Accords. A very complicated figure, ruthlessly ambitious, a careerist, utterly Machiavellian in the sense that I think he looked at everyone around him as either something that advanced Richard Holbrooke or didn't. And if you didn't advance Richard Holbrooke, he had no time for you. Very bright. I was working for the New York Times, so I was a very vital component in the build-up to Dayton. Indeed, when he landed in Zagreb or Belgrade, if I was there, one of the first things he did was send one of his aides to go out and find me. I supported the intervention in Bosnia. I was in Sarajevo during the war. And Holbrooke employed, you know, Martin Luther used to say, our greatest sin is our greatest strength. And Martin Luther being an egomaniac, an alcoholic, and an anti-Semite, had the capacity to stand up to the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. And the very characteristics that made him do it were also the characteristics that made him a very unpleasant human being. And I'd say the same was true with Holbrooke. He lied, controlled, manipulated the Balkan leaders into Dayton. He had many of the qualities of the very leadership that he was massaging into a peace agreement, and I would say even tricking and manipulating into a peace agreement. But in the end, the peace agreement ended a war that left a quarter of a million dead, including several thousand children in Sarajevo. And I have to laud the process. while I'm not at all blind about the character who carried it out, he was deeply complicitous in the massacres in East Timor. He was one of the mandarins that continued the war. Indeed, he wrote part of the Pentagon Papers. So and that's a kind of snapshot, I think, of at once who he is, and yet I have a kind of begrudging respect for him, for Dayton, and for what he did in Yugoslavia.
Chris Hedges, before we go back to the phone lines, I want to ask you about the Afghanistan War, which Holbrooke was working on up to his death. And you've been busy this week demonstrating against this war. What is your take on the Afghanistan War, where it's going, and what it means?
Well, we're losing the war, which even the policymakers, if you read between the lines, concede. We've replicated the Red Army's disastrous 10-year attempt to occupy Afghanistan, in that we control porous urban areas, use the word porous because attacks can still take place in places like Kandahar or Kabul. But only 20% of the Afghan population lives in urban areas. 80% live in the countryside, and that is essentially disputed or in the hands of the Taliban. We are backing a deeply detested figure in government, in the figure of Karzai, which has become the most potent recruiting tool the Taliban has. We talk about violations carried out by the Taliban, which of course are real. But once you employ industrial violence on the level that we have in Afghanistan, any belief that you can impose a virtue through these instruments of violence, and I speak as someone who's spent many years watching warfare up close, is an absurdity. Whatever sins the Taliban commit towards women, in no way compares with the widespread killing of civilians, some 15,000 at least, in Afghanistan, coupled with the rapes and abuse and corruption of the occupying forces that we are holding up. So it's a war that I think at this point is being fought primarily to enrich private contractors, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Halliburton, KBR, Blackwater, now renamed Z. There are people who don't give a damn whether this war is going badly or going well. For them, it's a good business, and unfortunately, these forces have a lock on government policy. And so this war keeps grinding on and on and on, not because it's working or not because it's going to be ultimately successful, but because it's making a lot of very heinous figures embodied in people like Dick Cheney rich.
Our guest, Chris Hedges, author of Death of the Liberal Class. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters coming to you live over WILL AM 580 today, December 19th, 2010. Let's go back to the phone lines to a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently. We'll start first with line two, Urbana. You're on the air with Chris Hedges.
Yeah, hi. This is a pretty basic question, but wondering if Mr. Hedges could explain the relationship between liberalism and empire. I'd be interested to hear what his take on the connection is between liberalism and empire.
All right,
That's a really important question, actually.
Well, he's come to the right person to ask it to. Go ahead, Chris.
Because that is one of the primary roles of the liberal class, and why a traditional power elite will tolerate a liberal class. If you look at the buildup to the war in Iraq, the established liberal class, embodied in figures like Michael Ignatieff, who's now the head of the Liberal Party in Canada, but who was at the Carr Center at Harvard for Human Rights, Bill Keller, who was a columnist for The Times and is now the executive editor of The Times, David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, even all of the people who are now purportedly anti-war writers, including Frank Rich, George Packer, all these people, supported the war. And they supported the war, not, they would say, because they liked war. It was a heartfelt decision. It was hard for them. They identified themselves as reluctant hawks. And this gave a kind of moral cover, a moral veneer to the war that figures like Bush and Cheney could never sell to an American public. And once the war went bad, these liberal critics were allowed to go back and say, Thomas Friedman was a classic example of this. Although I don't consider them liberals, they identify themselves as liberals within the society. They go back and will write that we weren't prepared for the insurgency, we didn't have enough troops to occupy, the planning was inept. But they don't critique the virtues or the intent of the power elite. And that makes their critiques acceptable. Once you cross that line and start attacking the military-industrial complex itself, the corporate state, the disease of empire, and it is a disease, then you are pushed outside of the narrow confines of the liberal establishment. So liberal apologists for war and empire are exceedingly important because they seduce a skeptical public and allow enterprises that are criminal, and preemptive war under post-Nuremberg laws is criminal. It is defined as a criminal war of aggression. It's illegal. They give them a kind of moral patina that the masters of war, the Cheneys, the Bushes, the Petraeuses, the McChrystals, are unable to do.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to line 3. Champagne, you're on the air with Chris Hedges.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes. Well, I was following the. You were on the ground in the Balkans, and I respect your opinion, but I'm very persuaded by Chomsky and Herman and other writers who. Mm-hmm. Chomsky's book, I don't know if you've wrestled with it. Military humanism, lessons from Kosovo. But regarding Holbrooke, I'm not surprised, but I'm just aghast that PBS used in two of their shows, Need to Know and NewsHour, used associates of Holbrooke who are spooky and, you know, DeGrapante was in Operation Phoenix with him. Weissner was, too. Weissner was on this Need to Know show. He was the liaison to the KLA in Kosovo and was doing things even in those days of supposedly running al-Qaeda types in to help the KLA fight their war.
Are you talking about Holbrooke?
Excuse me? Weissner. Frank Weissner, Jr.?
Yeah, he wasn't.
Who's an associate of Holbrooke's? And
yeah, I know Weissner. They were blindsided by the KLA, and I know that intimately because I was the first reporter from anywhere to make an armed to travel with an armed unit inside Kosovo. And when I met with General Wesley Clark later, and he asked me about, you know, what kind of weapons they had and how many there were and stuff. At one point, he slammed his hand down on the table and go, Langley has no one on the ground. The CIA had nobody in Kosovo with the rise of that war. The primary funders and backers of the KLA, I don't know, this is really probably a little off the mark of the program, were the Albanian security service, who backed Thaçi, who's now the prime minister, and there were a series of assassinations, many of the commanders who I knew within the KLA, and I believe they were carried out by Albanian security had decided to promote Thaçi at the expense of more moderate and less criminal elements within the KLA.
Well, Weissner, anomaly, was the liaison of the KLA in that period, right? So I'm with you
on those figures. I mean, the idea, and I hope that when I spoke about Holbrooke before, I was very clear that he is a very problematic figure, one whose hands, you know, especially in places like Vietnam and East Timor, are covered with a lot of blood, and I would say Afghanistan as well.
and Vietnam before that. And
yep.
But it's just the idea of your. I mean, he's the liberal element in the empire.
Yeah.
It's,
well, there you go. That's right.
It's terribly frustrating to see.
Right.
And the crisis in Pacifica and alternate views getting on the air is just keep up. It's hard to keep up my spirit sometimes. Keep up the good work, and I wanted to mention also that it's astonishing we don't hear more people decrying the CIA leakers who leaked the NIE just to undercut apparently the gloss that the Pentagon and Obama administration tried to just put on Afghanistan. I guess maybe there's some sober spooks that actually think that it was important enough to leak that, but they aren't being decried the same way that Assange is.
Well, I think it's important with Assange to note that Assange is very different from Ellsberg, who he and I were just arrested at the White House on Thursday in a huge anti-war demonstration with 131 veterans from Veterans for Peace. Because Assange functions, in essence, the way the New York Times functioned during the Pentagon Papers. We don't know who leaked Assange the documents. It may have been Manning. We don't know. But the difficulty in prosecuting him is that, of course, the New York Times has run a lot of this material. And I think it shows the kind of weakness of the Internet in that, in essence, replicating a leak of the magnitude of the Pentagon Papers, a figure like or an institution like WikiLeaks, which functions no differently from the way the New York Times functioned when they published the Pentagon Papers, is much more vulnerable. They don't have that kind of institutional power with which to fight back.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller, assuming you're still there, for calling in. I want to, Chris Hedges, I'd like to go back to your book a little bit right now. And, you know, one of the key points you make in the book is that successful existing liberals who've sort of made their peace with the corporate and military establishment, part of their way they prove their value is to continually expel dissidents and purge them, the sort of dissident liberals who, or people of the left who are not with the program. And that's how they prove their worth to those in power and maintain the privileges they get. And I assume that's a fair characterization of your argument?
Yes.
Okay, well, you also then have a long discussion in the book of a number of people who have been expelled, who've been the victims of sort of liberal outrage because they were, in your view, truth tellers. And several of these people, I think, are worth talking about. You've mentioned a few of them already in the show, but there are a few I'd like you to talk a little bit about for our listeners who might not be that familiar with them or might not have seen much media coverage of them, but their stories are very important. And I'd like to start with Richard Goldstone. If you talk a little bit about, you know, why he was cast out.
Goldstone is a South African judge who was reluctantly recruited by the UN to write a report of the 22 aerial bombardment and ground assault carried out by the Israelis on Gaza, and had the moral fortitude and integrity, although he's Jewish, considers himself a Zionist. His daughter made Aliyah, which means she emigrated and became an Israeli citizen. He sits on the board of Hebrew University to denounce the war crimes that the Israelis committed within the report. And he was immediately expelled from the liberal class because he had crossed a line that is unacceptable. Especially within Jewish liberal circles, which equates Israel with Judaism, an utter absurdity for those of us such as myself who's lived in Israel. And it was personal and brutal and left him a pariah. And it was one of, as you point out, a few examples that I talk in the book of people who have the moral autonomy to speak truth, but challenge the parameters that are set up by a liberal class that has a close collaboration with the power elite. The figure that liberals hate most, or self-identified liberals hate most, is not Glenn Beck. It's Noam Chomsky, because Chomsky continually exposes this collusion between the liberal establishment and delineates those parameters that cannot be crossed if you are to remain within that establishment. And Goldstone, very tragically, was expelled or ejected from traditional liberal circles because he had the courage to speak the truth.
Yeah, and there's two other people I want to talk about, then we'll get back to the phone lines. But there's so many I'd like to talk to in this book, Chris Hedges, but these two, I think, demand your comments, who are Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. You talk about quite a bit in the book and their importance and their role and their treatment in sort of dominant liberal culture today.
Well, King and Malcolm X are very important for understanding the limitations of the liberal class. And they're fascinating figures who not only played off of each other throughout their lives, but by the end of their lives had really come almost to the same point. You had King going to Watts after the riots and talking about how they've turned my dream into a nightmare. We've frozen King, or the commercial media's frozen King in 1963 with little black children, little white children, and the I Have a Dream speech. But King was a real radical. And the difference between King and Malcolm X is that King built his movement with the support of a white, primarily northern, liberal establishment. But once King began to understand, and King's personal experience was very different from Malcolm's in that King grew up in an upper-middle-class home, he had plenty of money, he was highly educated. Malcolm grew up in a foster home on the streets of Roxbury and Harlem and then went to prison. Malcolm had no trust or relationship with the liberal class at all. But once King began to speak in a language Malcolm understood, which is that there was no racial justice until there was economic justice. Desegregation was not an issue for Malcolm. Malcolm could technically go down to Manhattan and sit at a lunch counter and buy a coffee. The problem was he didn't have the money for a coffee. He understood that most African Americans and places like Harlem didn't have were locked out economically, that a system of economic deprivation functioned as a kind of barrier, as it still does, to keep African Americans out of privileged white society. And when King began to speak in that kind of radical voice, culminating with his anti-war address at Riverside in April of 1967, a year before he was assassinated, the liberal elite walked out on him, including Johnson, who had provided four plainclothes FBI agents as security. That security was withdrawn, something that both Johnson and King understood very well, or knew very well what that meant. King and Malcolm, I think, are a nice window into the limitations of the liberal class. If you are a white liberal, to call for segregation in the South is relatively painless. If you do what King did at the end of his life, which is walk into places like Chicago and call for economic justice and the reintegration of northern cities. And remember, King got to Chicago. He said he'd never experienced hate like he did in Chicago. You see how fast the liberal class ran from King. Figures like King and Malcolm, who are at their core not liberals but radicals, I think are a way to view the severe limitations of a liberal establishment, even when that establishment functioned as it did during the civil rights movement. I would argue that at this point, these liberal institutions, these pillars of the liberal establishment, are so anemic that they've become virtually irrelevant within American society.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller, this time to line one. You're on the air with Chris Hedges. Thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Mr. Hedges, I'd like your opinion of what the United States should have done after the 9/11 attacks in 2001.
Well, and it's a good
one
question.
One more question, please. Do you think that the planners of that attack were totally justified in their past efforts and current efforts to to continue to do so until the United States changes its approach to the Middle East. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Chris Edges?
Well, the attacks of 9/11 were a crime against humanity. They were an act of terrorism. Those who planned those attacks understood that huge explosions and death above a city skyline were a very effective form of communication, straight out of Hollywood. And we have been delivering that kind of form of communication for decades. 1965, McNamara, when he began bombing North Vietnam, talked about it as sending a message, a means of communication to Hanoi, a means of communication that left hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese dead. So, in essence, what happened on 9/11 is that these people learned to speak the language we taught them. I'm not excusing the act. I'm just stating a historical reality. The tragedy of 9/11 is that we didn't understand that you can't make a war on terrorism. Terrorism is a tactic. It's been with us since Sallust wrote about it in the Jugurthine Wars. It's not going away. The only way to defeat terrorism is to isolate terrorists within their own society. And after 9/11, I covered al-Qaeda for the New York Times, based in Paris, in Europe, and the Middle East. And we had garnered the empathy of not only most of the world, but the Muslim world, that was appalled at what had been done in their name. If we had had the courage to be vulnerable, if we had built on that enemy, al-Qaeda would be a marginalized and irrelevant force. Instead, we responded in precisely the language that al-Qaeda wanted us to respond, and that was the language of force, dropping iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East, and now, of course, Pakistan and Yemen. And this has become the most potent recruiting tool radical movements like al-Qaeda have. This was should have been an intelligence war. It should have been directed surgically against a small organization that operates not out of any particular nation state, but failed states.
You know, Chris Hedges, unfortunately, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. And before we say goodbye to you, Chris, I do want to let our listeners know that 1 week from today, we'll be having a special encore presentation of the last interview we did with Chalmers Johnson earlier this year, the late Chalmers Johnson, who passed last month. And so I hope you'll tune in for that. But as for now, I want to thank Chris Hedges for taking time from his busy schedule to join us to talk about his new book, Death of the Liberal Class, just out with Nation Books. Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great. And I also want to thank, as always, Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Krohoff for working the board. I'm Bob McChesney. Everyone, have great holidays and see you soon.